Welcome to Healthcare Confidential, where we bring healthcare innovators and experts together to discuss the American healthcare system, the levers that make it work, and the pitfalls that keep it from working as well as it should. I'm your host, Teresa Jacobellis. If there's one word that I would use to sum up 2020 so far, I would pick the word crisis. Over the past 10 months, we've endured a public health crisis like nothing seen in the last century. We also have raging wildfires that are devastating the West Coast, an unusually active and damaging hurricane season here in the East, not to mention an epic financial crisis that's affecting millions of Americans. So in light of all this, I could think of no better guest for today's podcast than Doug Levy, who literally wrote the book on communicating during a crisis. Doug has spent more than 20 years at the intersection of technology, science, health, policy, and ethics, and he's now a consultant to corporations, academic institutions, and other organizations on crisis communications and reputation management. His first book, The Communications Golden Hour, The Essential Guide to Public Information When Every Minute Counts, reached number one in the public relations and public administration categories on Amazon when it was released 2 years ago. And now there's a follow-up, The Communications Handbook for Coronavirus. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here. It's my favorite topic.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Before we get started, though, I mean, I only summarized very briefly your career, but you've actually had a very interesting and varied career. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the different roles that you've had as both a communications professional and a journalist?
I kind of got into healthcare from the outside as a journalist, as a reporter. When I was really young, I was really interested in police and detective stories. And in my first reporter roles, I discovered that disease detectives are actually even cooler than the ones that carry badges and guns. And that drew me toward covering healthcare and eventually leaving the newsroom and going to work at Johns Hopkins initially. And that was amazing because it was like getting a crash course in how medical research is done. I then went back into journalism and became a specialty medical and health reporter for a while. And wound up coming back to the academic side where I led communications at the UCSF School of Medicine and then in New York at the Columbia University Medical Center. And, you know, both places are amazing institutions where so much is going on, both research and clinical care, and a lot of crises.
Absolutely. And so my background is in hospital communications as well. And I know in those academic settings and in hospitals, crisis planning is kind of baked into the operational workflow, right? It's part of what you do. But what about other healthcare entities? Do other types of entities also need to do crisis planning?
I think every entity, whether you're a mom and pop business all the way up to a global conglomerate, everybody has to have at least some kind of a crisis plan, because no matter what the crisis may be, if you're just starting to think about how to deal with it while it's already underway, it's too late. And a lot of the planning that you do for a crisis will be useful for your day-to-day ordinary business, because the whole point of crisis planning is to identify vulnerabilities and mitigate them.
So it's actually a prevention strategy in a sense.
Absolutely. And in fact, you know, the crises that get out of control are the ones that are either not recognized early enough or the ones that are confronted by people who are completely unprepared.
So can you sort of follow that thread through and tell us like the downside, what happens when you don't have a robust communication plan, or worse, if you fumble the communications during a disaster?
Well, the reason that my book is called The Communications Golden Hour is that from the many crises that I've been involved in, it's easy to see that even if you don't know what the answer is, what you say and what you do within the first hour or less of an emergency of any size frequently will determine what the ultimate outcome is. Having clear lines of communication, knowing who needs to be in the room to decide things, knowing what resources you have, knowing who needs to know what is going on, all that should be done ahead of time. Because once the flames show up, or the bodies are in front of you, or the news media is at your door, it's kind of late and it's very difficult to catch up if you're starting out with a deficit. And what we've seen in countless examples is an organization that's unprepared to respond to an emergency, both with whatever physical or other response is necessary, but also the public communications aspect. If you aren't able to do that communications well, somebody else is going to fill in the gap, and that's not going to be somebody who's on your side. That's going to be somebody who maybe even is making stuff up. But if you don't have the credibility, if you don't establish your authority very quickly, the story is going to be completely out of control. And that can have actual life and death consequences. We have seen that, unfortunately, in numerous examples.
Yeah, I tell my communication grad students that they need to control the narrative, right? Which is what I think you're saying. And the other thing I tell them is that misinformation will fill the void. So if they're not
exactly
out there telling the story as they know the facts to be, then somebody else will create an alternate narrative. So I know you've done a lot of volunteer work as a firefighter in Howard County, Maryland, and you've worked with the NYPD Community Council as a volunteer. How did those experiences inform your approach to emergency planning?
Working with the New York City Police Department was really interesting because, you know, my role was as a civilian community relations volunteer. My precinct had an unusual mix of highly active communicators because it just happened there were quite a few journalists and artists and folks whose life revolves around communications, in addition to a large population that was completely disconnected. So it was this kind of odd dichotomy. But because of that unusual aspect and some other factors, my precinct wound up being the very first New York City precinct with a Facebook page. And I can't take any credit for that, but I did have the interesting experience of helping educate the precinct commander on what is this thing called Facebook. NYPD had already adopted Twitter as its main day-to-day communications tool, but Facebook is a different kind of animal. And it's not the way folks who wear uniforms and are very official typically engage. But it's also an amazing tool to build the relationships that you absolutely must have, so that when something bad happens, people will listen to what you're saying.
Interesting. I did want to touch upon that because I know that you are an advocate of using social media channels, particularly to communicate during a crisis. What do you think makes them so well suited to that kind of communication?
You need to make sure that you are where your audience is instead of expecting them to come to you. One of the mistakes that I used to see all the time, and thankfully much less recently, is that, you know, people would, you know, companies would say, sign up for our emergency alert system. No. If you've got something important to tell your audience, you find them. And in many communities, Facebook is where people are. Now, of course, there are many other channels now. There's Nextdoor, there is Twitter, TikTok, Snapchat, Instagram, Pinterest. The list is long. Don't get on all of them. but figure out where the people that you need to be communicating with are and engage. They're also really good tools for listening. And if you really want to be alert to a crisis before it flares up, you need to be listening to what people are saying about you on social media. That's also, I mean, for physical safety, that's important.
Yeah, excellent advice. So let's kind of take it back to basics. If somebody is listening and they're maybe managing a medical practice, or they've got a company that's maybe in the tech space connected to healthcare, what are the elements of an emergency plan that they should have in place?
So one of the things that we discovered in the early days of the COVID pandemic is that many, particularly smaller organizations, did not really have a crisis plan, or if they did, it didn't imagine things like having to announce an employee's illness or death, or an unexpected shutdown of a facility. You know, that probably wasn't part of the plan. But the companies that were prepared at least had a process for figuring that out. So every organization should, at a minimum, have a clear document or other place where the information is stored that includes things like contact information for decision makers. Who's got access to the social media accounts or the website? Because nothing's going to hurt you more than a cheerful photo on your homepage if you are dealing with an accident or incident where there's dead people. You know, the airline industry, sadly, has had to deal with this many times, and Alaska Airlines actually has done this so well in the two incidents that I'm aware of that they've had where there have been deaths. You know, you have a dark website ready to go, you flick a switch, and you know, you go into plain vanilla communications mode, no pretty pictures.
And you're pausing every other social media and advertising message campaign that's out there.
Oh, yes, absolutely. You need to make sure that there's a way to very quickly stop anything that's been pre-programmed for posting later on. This is why, particularly if you're in a regulated industry, this is important. There should be central control of all the social media channels. So there are many tools that make this possible. And one of the best reasons to have that is there should be one person who can push a button and literally take over all the accounts. NYPD learned that one the hard way, actually. They had each precinct had its own Twitter account, so 77 separate Twitter accounts. And when the bombing happened in Chelsea, they had not made it explicitly clear that the precincts needed to stop communicating because there was a major incident. And there was some information that was posted by one of those other commanders that the folks running the incident didn't want out. Now, it didn't have any serious consequences in this case, but you don't want that to happen. So right after that, one of the things that they figured out, because reviewing what happens after an emergency is important, one of the immediate things they did after that was they set a policy in place where if there's a major incident, all social media stops except for what's coming from headquarters. And if you watch the NYPD when there's a major incident, they do this now really, really well. They're also really fast. Their standard is to have something posted in less than 20 minutes from the first report of a major incident. And they aim to get somebody in front of the cameras within about 90 minutes if it's a critical incident.
And there's a lot that has to happen in order for that person to be able to stand there and speak knowledgeably about whatever's happened. But I want to just circle back to something you alluded to, which is the importance of having a consistent message across all of your channels too. So I think that speaks to also having that centralized control, because there's nothing that creates chaos more than just different types of information, different messages being put out on different channels or by different people.
It's possible that this is from my firefighting background, but this is where having a clear command structure comes into play. And in the organizations where I have worked, you have your day-to-day process where people usually get to do their own thing. But if it is an actual emergency, that authority changes, and the only people who can communicate are the people that are managing that emergency. And within the integrated command structure that has been developed after 9/11, you have a communications person who is responsible for messaging about the emergency, and no messages go out unless the incident commander looks at it, reviews it, and says it's okay. And that's a really good process. It doesn't add time. It actually makes things faster, and it prevents the kinds of problems that can, in some cases, cost lives, because you absolutely do not want one person saying, evacuate southbound on Route 100, and another agency say, evacuate northbound on Route 100.
Right. And it's what's interesting to me is that when you talk about the incident command person, that's not always the person at the top. I mean, to avoid a bottleneck, many times it should not be, right? You don't want to have one person with all of the responsibility during a disaster if something is activated. So that incident command person might be somebody who doesn't normally have a role like that in the day-to-day operations.
Exactly. And this is the sort of thing that ideally is sorted through long in advance of an actual emergency. You know, there are many incidents where you do need to have the CEO or somebody of that level involved, but I can't think of any situation where it's particularly useful to have the chief executive of a major organization actually hands-on making the emergency decisions. You have to have the proper delegated authority, and it doesn't mean you don't, you know, get the person on the phone saying, hey, we're about to do this. Is it okay?
And we've seen cases where that's actually been counterproductive, which I'd love to talk about with you a little bit more, but we're going to pause for a very brief break. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more from Doug Levy. Welcome back to Healthcare Confidential. We're here with Doug Levy, healthcare crisis communication expert, and we're talking about the chain of command during a crisis. And Doug, I think you said that you can give us an example of how sometimes that incident commander is shouldn't always be the CEO or the person at the top in an operational sense.
You want to make sure that you're not tying up the CEO with minute-to-minute decisions. That's rarely what their job normally entails anyway. You do need to make sure that the CEO and probably your directors know what the crisis plan is, know how things are managed when there's an emergency. But it's critical, and this is particularly in large organizations, that the only people who are actually managing the emergency, they need to be people who have already learned what the process is and know how things are organized in an emergency. You're never going to be able to pre-plan everything. And in fact, I discourage that. But I absolutely urge people to not only have one layer of emergency management people, but your emergency management team should have at least a backup and ideally a backup to the backup, because we've probably all been in emergencies where the primary people are not there. And that's where your desktop drills, your pre-planning, your exercises really come in handy. I was involved in an exercise a few years ago where it was designed as a drill that was actually based on a very realistic scenario. And the whole point of the drill was to make it that none of the people available for the Emergency Operations Center were the people who were primarily in those roles. So it was all the backup people had to step up and run the incident.
Interesting.
And it was really important because I've seen that happen. And in fact, we've seen that in many hospitals. We saw that in San Bernardino when we had the terrorist incident a few years back with, I think, 14 people killed. The police department had no public information officer because the PIO was on leave and there was nobody designated as the backup. Yeah. Luckily, an adjacent agency knew that was the problem and they just showed up, which was great. That's the way neighbors are supposed to help each other.
Well, in my experience too, there's frequently a little bit of friction between what communications wants to say. We were trained to be as transparent as we can be. And what legal has determined should be said or can be said. And I know that you are also an attorney. So I thought that you might have some perspective on how to balance those sometimes competing demands.
There's always going to be that tension, and it's important that in a large-scale emergency, there should be a legal person there, because there sometimes are things that might not be obvious to everybody else that have legal consequences. Sometimes it has to do with whether you're going to get reimbursed by FEMA, if that's an option. There's also questions of liability and all that stuff, which, you know, that's part of life. It's critical that whatever is communicated in any situation, really, has to be truthful. You know, lying about stuff doesn't help anyone ever. Disclosing everything may also not be particularly helpful to addressing the emergency. So in terms of figuring out whether the lawyer should be able to veto something or the communicator should be able to override, whatever, when you're deciding what to say, you must focus on what are you trying to accomplish with this message. If you have a facility that is about to get clobbered by a hurricane and you need to get people out of risk, what information do they need so that they know what the risk is, know how it's going to affect them, and know what to do? And everything else is secondary. Emergency messages that get fouled up usually have extraneous information that does not actually address the immediate need.
What I really liked about the communications golden hour is the way you created almost like checklists for the planning process for readers. What led you to write the book that way? And what has your response been? And who have you found to find it most useful?
Most of what's in that book is from firsthand experience, either from myself or the many, many other professional colleagues that I've worked with over the years. We've made lots of mistakes along the way. And every time there's been an emergency, we've reviewed what worked, what could have been better. And I've tried to boil things down to the things that happen in every emergency. And that's where your primary planning should go. Because in any emergency, you're going to need to have somebody who is your spokesperson. In any emergency, you're going to have to know who makes the decisions. In any emergency, you're going to need to know who's got the keys to your Twitter account. That has to be planned out ahead of time. All the other stuff, like what to say if it's a wild animal on the loose or a chemical spill, whatever, the specific emergency, those details, it's nice if you plan ahead, but much less important. And that's kind of the process I've used. It's like, what do you need to do in any emergency? And what are the resources that you have? What are the resources that you need? And what other resources can you tap? because you want to know who else can help you.
So it's about really balancing the planning as much as you can, and then also being flexible and knowing that you're going to have to pivot in the moment to adapt to whatever those circumstances are. And sometimes they're foreseen and other times they're completely unforeseen.
This is also why planning and practicing is really, really important. And we've seen many situations where people have had great plans, but nobody's actually read them. Doesn't do any good. And when you do even I used to do 15-minute just refreshers with my team in New York, where, you know, once a month we'd start a meeting and I'd just say, okay, here's the scenario. What do we do? And that helped keep people sharp. It also helped us identify things that weren't in place that needed to be.
And then I think also to your point, the reviewing the actual disaster, the crisis after it's happened. And it's super important to do it while it's still fresh in everyone's mind, and to have everyone at the table and to have the ability to kind of frankly and honestly evaluate what worked, what didn't, what should we get rid of, what should we keep. Very important to moving forward and baking that into, codifying that into the plan going forward.
Absolutely. Hospitals and law enforcement are both pretty good at that. Law enforcement really has that down into a system. A couple of times a year during normal times, I'm in briefings where any department that has had a major incident, whether it was the Las Vegas massacre or Ferguson, Missouri, or whatever, reports on what they did and what they figured out from their own review. And part of their reason for presenting that to other departments and other experts is so that they learn more. And nobody wants to see other people make the same mistakes.
So just in closing, because this has gone by so quickly, and I want to get your advice before we go. For most, let's say, small to mid-size organizations, especially in healthcare and medical practices, do you recommend that this is something they can handle on their own internally with guidance such as with your book? Do they need to bring in an outside consultant? What's the best way to proceed moving forward?
My recommendation would be look at the potential risk. And if you don't have anybody who is a communications professional or an emergency planning professional, because you need both, then I would recommend engaging a consultant, just because it's not going to cost a lot of money to get just the basics. Even if you develop it yourself, have somebody outside review it. You may have a professional association or a chamber of commerce even, where you could just work with neighbors and share expertise. And that's going to be very helpful. You don't want to miss an important step. But again, focus on your actual risks. So what are the most likely bad things that could happen? And then think a bit out of the box. What are some of the bad things that maybe you wouldn't think could happen, but maybe happen to somebody else? And then think about some of the stuff that is in common across those incidents. So for example, unfortunately now, every employer probably should have some kind of written guidelines for what do you do if an employee gets really sick or dies. There's so many complicated issues surrounding what you can say or do about that. I mean, this is where you want the HR and the legal and the communications people, as well as operations people, to think ahead of time to sort it out. Because, I mean, I can tell you back in April when I was working with people who had never had an employee death to announce before, you know, if somebody you know is dying or just died from something terrible like COVID-19, you don't really want to be dealing with the business stuff. But if you didn't do it ahead of time, you're going to have to.
Great advice. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us here on Healthcare Confidential, Doug. Tell our listeners how they can connect with you and learn more about you, please.
You can find me on Facebook. The easiest way to find me is just to search for Doug Levy PR, or on Twitter, I'm SF Doug, and I have a a newsletter that's almost every day where I do the top stories related to COVID-19. You can subscribe to that at Doug Levy, DougLevy.substack.com.
Excellent. All right. Thank you again. And I want to remind everyone that new Healthcare Confidential episodes are available on heliumradio.com on Mondays at 10 a.m. and on the Care One Network and at 2 p.m. on the Life Improvement Radio Network. You can listen on demand wherever you access podcasts. Our show is produced by Life Improvement Media with thanks to Eric Remmel and Justin Ulrich. Our theme song is an original composition written and performed by the amazing Patrick Pekarsik, whose birthday is today. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe and leave us your feedback and help us continue the conversation by leaving a comment on the Healthcare Confidential Facebook page. Be well, everyone.